The A2 amendment answers a concern of Representative Holbrook.
That's a little better. Turn the speaker on.
Oh, there you go.
I will move amendment H2265A2. We got more than one.
All right. Thank you. Briefly, in 2000...
Well, I think we'll vote on that. We'll add it. They're all in favor of that. We'll please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Well, we have your bill in shape now, so go ahead.
All right. Thank you. In 2012, a consortium of states, politically balanced with both Republican and Democratic secretaries of states, created an organization called Electronic Registration Information Center, ERIC for short. The sole mission is to assist states to improve the accuracy of the voter records and to increase access to voter registration. We live in a nation of very mobile people, and it takes a concerted effort among the states to keep their voter rolls accurate. The bill before us would permit Minnesota to join this consortium in order to improve the integrity of our voter rolls and assist our voter outreach. I have with me today John Lindback, Executive Director of ERIC, and Beth Frazier from the Secretary of State's office.
Welcome. And identify yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Lindback. I am Executive Director of the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC. As the author of this legislation just mentioned, it is a consortium of states that banded together to improve the accuracy of voter rolls, reduce costs, and improve efficiency for state and local election offices. ERIC was recently endorsed by the Presidential Commission on Elections Administration that was chaired by the chief lawyers for both the Romney campaign and the Obama campaign. It was a federal commission appointed by the president, chaired by those two lawyers, and it was one of the things that they agreed on, that that states should exchange data and match data within their own boundaries in order to improve the accuracy of voter registration lists. And, of course, you may remember that they were appointed to look at the issue of long lines originally. Their scope was actually a little broader than that when they met, but in regards to the issue of clean voter registration lists, it's one of the chief ways you can keep lines short on election day is to have a list that is as clean as possible. So the goal of ERIC is to balance accuracy and access, and it matches data submitted by the states. And they want to better identify voters who have died and those names linger on the voter registration lists. They want to find and reconcile duplicate registrations within your own state voter registration database. And ERIC helps states keep up with the mobile electorate. Every year, at least one in eight people move in this country, and the mobility is particularly acute among young people, where every year one in four of them move and change locations. And that, of course, affects their voter registration. It must be updated. And so the goal is to target voter registration for people when they move. ERIC is fully operational. It's now run by the states, totally. It was incorporated in May of 2012. There is a membership agreement that you can review online at www.ericstates.org. There are two full-time employees that operate the organization. There's a technical employee, a systems engineer, and who routinely takes the uploads from the states, runs them through the data matching engine, and provides reports back to the states. And of course, we're also out recruiting new members. The current ERIC states include Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Utah, and Colorado, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, and the District of Columbia. And so you can tell by the nonpartisan nature of this organization, there are states that are red, states that are blue, and states that are purple. The reports that go back to the states include a report about in-state movers, and that's where my understanding of the jurisdiction of the state comes in, this particular committee comes in that each state submits their voter registration data and their DMV data, their motor vehicles database. And those And those two databases are matched along with the Social Security Death Index and very soon, hopefully, National Change of Address data from the U.S. Post Office. We'll have that incorporated into ERIC in the next year. The reports that come back then give you an indication of in-state movers. Those people, for example, when you match the DMV data against the voter registration data, it tells the elections officials which people on the voter registration list have a more recent address on file in the DMV database. That enables the ERIC states to reach out to those voters and encourage them to update their registration so that all of the there are fewer lines on election day, you don't have so many same-day registrations in the case of Minnesota, and it works better for things like candidates. As you all know, you've had the experience of going door-to-door and finding people aren't there when you thought they were. There's also reports going out to the states about cross-state movers, so they get a report back on somebody who lived in their state and moved to another state so they can reach out to those people and start the process for encouraging them to help in canceling their registration. The match against the Social Security Death Index provides a report on deceased individuals who are still on the voter rolls. It provides a report on duplicate registrations within your state. Some of the ERIC states have found surprising numbers of registrations, duplicate registrations by the same person, somebody who's maybe moved from one county to another and you didn't catch them, and so there's two. And there's a report that's about people who are potentially eligible to vote, but as yet unregistered, and again, that goes back to that match between the DMV data. These would be people who are on the DMV list, who are old enough to vote, but do not appear on the voter registration list, and the states get a report on those people so that they can reach out to those people and encourage them to vote. So there is both an integrity component to ERIC and the activities of the ERIC states and an access component where you're trying to clean up your list and you're also trying to encourage people who are not registered to register and to vote. Just a few statistics for you on ERIC. As of February 2014, ERIC has reported almost $1.3 million in-state movers to the participating states. It's reported almost 230,000 cross-state movers, just over 47,000 deceased individuals who are on the rolls in those states. And about 29,000 duplicate registrations within the state voter registration databases, and about 6.1 million people who are eligible but are not registered to vote in those states. The Center for Democracy and Technology was brought in to help with the planning of ERIC at the very beginning. In order to account for security and privacy of the data. The folks who wanted this to get going wanted privacy and community or privacy and security advocates at the table, providing suggestions on how to handle this data and keep it secure. The Center for Democracy and Technology issued a report that said that ERIC had done everything it can possibly do to keep the data secure, that it was satisfied with the plans for ERIC, and that it goes far beyond what the individual states are doing in order to keep their own data secure. So I'll stop there and allow for questions and be open for questions and follow-up. www.ericstates.org provides a short 2-minute video on ERIC. That people like, and I'll leave my contact information with you for any of the committee members.
Just a curiosity question. With the problem that government has had with large electronic masses moving around and making any sense out of it, Is the government hired a private contractor to do the information exchange here, or who's handling that?
Mr. Chair, the states are handling it themselves. This data matching technology was developed at IBM, and it's IBM software that's highly sophisticated software that provides matches that would not show up in sort of straight one-on-one matching that some of the states are doing now, because it allows for name variations. For example, John versus Jack, or Meg versus Margaret. If people use different names, the software will catch that and report the match. And so the states have hired two staff people, and I think what you're asking about, if I'm not mistaken, that's what we do, is we make sure that the matching takes place using the technology and that the reports go back out to the states.
Mr. Chair?
I
have liked what the testifier has described it, because I don't know the security very well, but they call it that you would want to know if this pig matched up with that pig, but you don't have the identity of the pig. You only have the sausage that is made from that pig, a string of numbers, and you're matching up the string of numbers, the end result, and across state lines you don't know who that identity is of that person that's back in the state.
I'm going to mention that this bill has been through civil law, too, so it's been vetted by the...
Yeah, it's been there.
For the committee. Any questions? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have just a couple of technical ones, and then I got one about the amendment that we just adopted. Remind me, Mr. Lindback, again, the membership. There are several states that are members now. I imagine they have a number of, that they contribute, a price to be members.
Yes.
Can you talk to me about what kind of number we're thinking here? Is it millions? Is it hundreds of thousands? What is it?
Yes, the board of directors, made up of the members, mm-hmm. Voted for. There's annual dues and there's an initiation fee. Each state pays $25,000 as an initiation fee, and that helps the organization remain liquid during this sort of phase-in period. And then there are annual dues, and the dues are based upon the budget, and it's divided up among the states according to a formula that's based on the total voting eligible population and the number of states in the group, which means larger states pay more than smaller states. Mm-hmm. But basically, the participating members are dividing up an annual budget of about $500,000. So if you were the 10th state, your annual dues would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000.
Mr. Chairman, another question, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Lindback. That's helpful. A question on the process. If we authorize this, and our Secretary of State and Department of Motor Vehicles is downloading data, it goes to your center. Where do the machinations take place, the matchups, the software do what it does? And then whenever we get a product out, is that available to all the states or only the states that are relevant? So we'll send you 100,000 pieces of data. Do we get back the ones we need to be aware of, or does everybody see it?
Each state receives only the data relevant to them. Mm-hmm. So okay, Colorado would see Colorado's data, Minnesota would see Minnesota's data, and if there was a match that involved both states, you'd only see that. You wouldn't see data that relates to Delaware and Maryland. Okay. I'm sorry, I forgot the first question already.
The first part was where does it actually go? Does it actually go to a mainframe that the association controls, or?
Yes, there are servers right now. That database is housed in outside of Milwaukee with a private vendor that I went and visited, and it's pretty amazing the amount of security around this building. And there is discussion about moving that to one of the member states in order to help save money. And we'll see where the board goes with that.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question about the amendment we adopted?
I don't know why not. It's part of the bill.
Okay, good deal. Thanks. Ms. Chair, and this may be for DBS, but let me start with Representative Lane. We adopted an amendment in Section 171.12, Subdivision 7A, which seems to prohibit DBS from giving information to anybody other than public safety for only certain particular instances. Am I misreading what the amendment does, or does this amendment actually then authorize, overcome the prohibitions in Subdivision 7A and actually say that they may give this information to HERIC or something like that?
My understanding is the amendment is initiated by Representative Holberg, who wanted to limit the amount of data that would go out.
Okay.
So this would be the data that would be allowed.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Beth Fraser, the Deputy Secretary of State. The base bill authorizes, adds a sentence to 171.12, Subdivision 7A, that authorizes driver and vehicle services to provide the data to the Secretary. And then the amendment limits exactly which data fields may be shared.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That helps shed some light on that. Thank you very much.
Is this the amendment the one that blocks Representative Holberg's records?
Bothers them.
Mr. Chair, it's related to a separate issue, but
it's okay.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, well, we might as well move this then. I think I would say we recommend that House File 2265 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. It's on its way to State Government Finance. Thank you. How we got two? We got more than one set of minutes here? Representative Hornstein, will you be help us today by moving the minutes of March 11th, please?
we're talking. I'd like.
I know that. That's why I called on you.
He's like a high school teacher. I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, all in favor? Any questions or additions?
Roll call, Mr. Chairman. I'm just kidding.
Okay. All in favor?
Too early
aye.
For us to be doing this.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes for March 11th are adopted. Who do we have? Oh, Representative Beinert. I will move. That we consider House File 2092.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish is here with me today because he laid the groundwork for this bill, and so we're doing this together today. House File 2092 authorizes a veteran's special motorcycle plate for combat wounded veterans.
I want to ask you a question first. You know if... Representative Cornish is carrying today?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Thank you.
Goes too short.
You always make me nervous with your, Western outfit on.
Mr. Chairman, I normally don't inquire of my colleague.
Well, it's that of privacy matter. That I was inquiring about. So.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 2092 has been long awaited by an active local group of Mankato wounded warriors, and in a few moments you will hear their story. Of course, any mention of license plates around the Capitol immediately provokes sweaty palms and fidgeting. Generally, everyone assumes that law enforcement will be unhappy with the proliferation of license plates, making it even more difficult for them to quickly read and assess. And of course, it will cost money. In this case, both of these issues have been addressed, and we will hear from the Department of Vehicle Services in a few minutes about some of that. But first, I want to call your attention to the bill itself. If you only looked at the bill, you might find difficulty figuring out what we're doing. The bill itself adds the letter E to existing statute in line 119 and line 122. So in order to help make more sense of that, I included in your packet the current statute 168.123. And if you take a look at that, you'll see at the bottom of the page a description of what the letter E stands for. For a combat wounded veteran who is a recipient of the Purple Heart Medal, the plates must bear the inscription, Combat Wounded Vet, and have a facsimile or an emblem of the official Purple Heart Medal. So it's that description that's being added to the language around motorcycle plates. Okay, so I've lost my place here, so just give me a second here. Okay, so you'll momentarily hear from the department about the process that they've already looked at putting in place and I think is ready to go once we move things forward here in the legislature. But before we get to the details around the fiscal note that you have in your packet and other questions you might have, I'd like you to hear first from those whose deeply felt pride and sacrifice began this journey. I'd like first to introduce Jason McNamara.
My name is Jason McNamara. I'm from Mankato, Minnesota. I served 5 years with the 101st Airborne, 1st and 506 Infantry. I was wounded in Iraq in 2006, and I spent 2 years at Walter Reed Hospital, and I actually will go in next month for my 14th reconstructive surgery on my legs. And I'm very proud and honored to have served our country. And many veterans and combat wounded veterans like myself are proud, and to be able to put these license plates on our motorcycle is a humble way of showing the people of our community our sacrifices and how proud we are to have served our country. That's all I have to say. Thank you for your time.
Representative Bynum, did you bring a sample? Did we talk about this? Or?
Yes, I was going to. I can share it now, but I was going to hand that around when Tom Evans from the department was testifying. But in the meantime, I'll start.
Okay.
This is a facsimile. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce our next testifier, Tom McLaughlin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm Tom McLaughlin, also from Mankato, and I am active with many veterans organizations and have been active as part of my rehabilitation of taking up motorcycle riding after I was wounded in Vietnam 44 years ago. One thing about this particular plate, I realize there are a lot of plates, a lot of vanity plates. I have a handicap plate on my personal vehicle that the department has to deal with, but the Purple Heart plate is out there. It is available already. This would be just extending it to motorcycles. In our mind, the Purple Heart recipient, the medal that we received for being wounded, serving our country, is unique amongst all the other awards that we may have for our service in the country. There's a sense of pride being a combat wounded veteran. When you shed blood for your country, all the other awards you might have don't quite mean as much as the Purple Heart does. And amongst our peers in the motorcycle community, that community is heavily populated with veterans, and veterans seem to appreciate the sacrifices that a combat wounded veteran makes. And it's not a plate that we want to get an attaboy when we go to the shopping center. It's more a sense of pride that we have, and it's something that we've earned with our blood. Thank you.
Representative Bynum?
Mr. Chair, I would like now to call Tom Evans from the Driver and Vehicle Services forward to answer any concerns around the fiscal note and how this might move forward.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Tom Evans. I'm the supervisor for the Special Plate Unit for Driver and Vehicle Services. And I'm willing to answer any questions you have about this bill.
Are these actually samples of metal plates, or
no? That's just the sheeting that's applied to the metal.
Oh,
so that's
what I mean is there be a metal backing to this?
Yes, there's a metal backing to that. Those are just for convenience and speed of getting them out to the representatives.
Is that the way the plates are, car plates are made now with one of these on them?
Yes, Representative. They're printed out on a large sheet of the sheeting material, which is highly reflective.
I mean, auto plates.
Yes, all of them.
Okay, and they are not embossed anymore then?
No, they aren't embossed anymore.
Okay. Are they still made down at in Stillwater?
They're made in the manufacturing facility in Rush City, correctional facility.
Oh, Rush City. Okay. Thank you. Questions? Representative Rundbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just noting, I mean, the cost is very low, and the revenues will also be low, because you're assuming, what, only 50 or 60 over the next few years would be sold? Is that correct?
Representative, I'm not. We don't have a good number. We base that number on the last motorcycle plates that were authorized, and we basically thought about only about 10% of those would qualify also for combat wounded. Mm-hmm. So that's what our numbers are based on. They could, you know, the first year could be higher, but this is just a preliminary thought. And most of our costs are recovered by the plate costs that they pay for the plates.
And your plate charges have been reduced a lot. I mean, your cost of manufacture have been reduced a lot by this method, then, I assume.
Unfortunately, the costs have remained about the same as they were for embossing plates. The digital license plate printer, its greatest asset is its flexibility. We can make a change to the plate design much more quickly than we could in the past. Also, it reduces a lot of the environmental footprint. We don't have to have paints and solvents anymore. It uses a four-color process, much like magazines do.
How long have these been out on in use?
The digital license plates have been issued since 2007. And we actually started back in 2002 with the Loon plates on a trial basis.
Are there any other questions or comments or whatever? Yes.
Mr. Chair, could we give Representative Cornish a moment's time?
I think so, as long as he's here, so we don't make him mad. We don't want to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tony Cornish, luckily for everybody involved, I'll keep it short because my voice is leaving me, but... I first ran into these folks at a outdoor exhibition for sporting goods and hunting and Shields, and they had a booth there and brought it up to me, the Wounded Warrior Bunch, and I talked to Mr. Evans of the Driver and Vehicle Service, and they were very cooperative, and we didn't know if it would work, so I asked them to run out a couple prototypes, and it turned out that they will work. And just so we keep it simple, it's just the already existing car plate shrunk down to a motorcycle plate, and I just add in ending that the guy that we introduced in the wheelchair the other day on the House floor and gave a standing ovation to, he isn't here today, but he supports the bill and hopes you wish favorably on it. So thank you very much for hearing us out today.
And Representative Briner.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Cornish, for all your help on the bill. I just have a few short words as a personal note I'd like to add in closing. The power in the place of the Purple Heart. My father died in World War II, and his Purple Heart weaves through the memories of my childhood. Sometimes my mom took it out to share with us. Other times I snuck into the cedar chest to have a peek. That, along with the picture of my dad in his uniform with a paper red poppy draped over the corner of the frame, have moved with me through my life and inspired me in numerous ways. We all honor and share the pride of those who have sacrificed for us. This is one small way of saying so. I hope you'll support the bill.
Any other questions? Are we ready to vote then? I guess all in favor of the recommendation of House File 2092 that be referred to the Committee on the General Register. Wow. All in favor of that, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Pull the same sign. Well, we'll see you on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure. Sir? Representative Murphy, are you? You are.
Are we up? We jump. Oh, sorry.
They told me third.
Are these Murphy's or what?
No one's going to vote against that.
First time in 19 terms.
Transportation Policy Committee?
Representative Murphy.
Wait, Mr. Chairman, did you hear that? This is the first time that Representative Murphy's been before the Transportation Policy Committee in 19 terms.
Well, I was wondering if we should let it appear today, because I remember it's been a long time. Are you rusty?
And now everyone's taking pictures. Look at that.
Okay, I'm going to move that House File 2208 be before us for consideration. Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some people to introduce before we start the bill. The bill was brought to me by my new constituents because of my new district. The citizens of Lake County and Two Harbors. And Mayor Boland from Lake County is here, and Commissioner Jeremy Hurd from Lake County, and Councillor Jerry Norberg from Two Harbors. And with me to speak today is Councillor Seth McDonald and our city planner, Josh Bergstead. But first of all, or second of all, I want to thank Matt Scher, the committee administrator, who when Two Harbors first contacted me with the problem that they were having with signage, Matt Scher met with me and people from very cooperative people from DOT, and we thought we were working out a solution. But it didn't come out exactly to meet the vision of the people that have been working on this for longer than the 1 year I've been with them. And so they proposed House File 2208, which would establish a more expansive city signage process for getting signs in the cities. And Seth McDonald is the one that is going to talk about the need.
Mr. Chair?
Welcome.
My name is Seth McDonald. I'm from the city of Two Harbors, where I'm a city councilor, planning commission member, and small business owner. I'm before you today to support House File 2208, which will help our city and its small businesses by establishing new rules for the community wayfinding sign program in cities along state highways. Highway 61 runs through Two Harbors, connecting us to Duluth to our south, and North Shore communities and destinations along Lake Superior to our north. However, many of our businesses and community destinations are not located along Highway 61. This includes the historical downtown waterfront district, Lake Superior shoreline. The enhancements to the Minnesota Department of Transportation's community destination sign program that House File 2208 makes possible are important tools in helping our city revitalize our downtown, share our history, and support existing and new business opportunities in less visible parts of our community. We have worked with state and local shareholders for several years to develop a wayfinding solution. We have worked with MnDOT, professional planners, professional engineers to develop a sign program that meets community needs and maintains sound planning and engineering practices, especially where safety is concerned. Some of the needs for an improved wayfinding sign program can only be accomplished with the legislature's support. We recently completed the visual concept shown, I believe, that you guys have in front of you today to help us communicate how an attractive and expanded community destination sign program can safely fit into the right-of-way of Highway 61. This visual concept is based on a mixture of allowed components: the color, overall size, location, and community identification marker, and components which would be made possible with House File 2208, including the addition of some private business destinations. I thank you for your consideration of the important community development opportunities that House File 2208 allows Two Harbors and other opportunities. I think two quick points is that there's an existing program that allows for this type of a structure to be built along Highway 61, and we had worked with a local engineer, I believe it was Rob Agee, in out of the Duluth office, and we had sites that were located, the physical signs were in accordance with existing law. The main restriction that he had was that private businesses were not allowed to be located on these signs. And as you can see on the demonstration, that there's a mixture of public destinations, but then we'd also like to, on each sign, have the placement of some private businesses on there as well. The other thing, the last thing I have before I turn it over for questions is, if you were located outside of the city limits of Two Harbors, 100 feet outside the city limits of Two Harbors, and you had a business, you would be able to get a sign that would have your private business name on it, pointing a direction to your location. But since this is inside the city limits of Two Harbors, we are not allowed that ability to promote and direct traffic that are actually interested and would like to know where our businesses and destinations are, simply because we're within this, the city limits of Two Harbors. So we're just looking for kind of some a level playing field for the businesses that are outside and inside the city limits of Two Harbors.
Did you go to find it?
I would be happy to answer any questions if you'd like.
Questions? Representative Pieser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to try to kind of paraphrase what I think I understood and what I'm reading between here. It sounds like the concern is, and the reason for needing it in the trunk highway right-of-way, is because the city's ordinance and so forth precludes what you're trying to do, and because it again, you said if you're outside city limits, you could do outside the right-of-way and have your information listed however you wish. Isn't that a little bit of a usurpation of the city's ability to maintain its zoning and sign development if we step in and say, okay, we understand that you have a certain requirement in this particular city, but we are going to step in and say, but you can do it as long as it's on our right-of-way. We have the authority to restrict that. I mean, I'm just concerned about us stepping on the toes of the local legislation and the jurisdiction in regards to signage, because signage is always a touchy situation.
Mr. Chair, clarification, within the city limits of Two Harbors, this would be allowed. The issue is it's along the MnDOT corridor, along Highway 61 is where the restriction is, and we're not allowed to do that. Our existing ordinances in the city of Two Harbors, if it's outside of this corridor, we have the existing ordinances that would actually allow for this type of a destination sign program, and we would make plans to do that along Waterfront Drive and some other areas that are specific to this program. But that first step along Highway 61, the state corridor, which MnDOT controls, does not allow for these types of signs to be located.
And just a quick follow-up question. So my understanding is then there isn't any spot outside of the right-of-way that these signs could be actually along that area would be able to be put up, correct?
Mr. Chair, outside this MnDOT corridor, we are able to today, we could build them today if we wanted to. Even if this does not go through, we plan to do that. But the concern is that this corridor is kind of the main thoroughfare, the first step as people are driving through Two Harbors. If we didn't have that, then it's not as useful of a tool to us, the signs that are located outside of the corridor.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let's see, Mr. McDonald. All right, so trying to understand, beyond allowing you to do this in your city, MnDOT's involvement would go how far? I mean, is this design something that, you know, they're authorizing, or is this just for us to look at and take a look at? And then secondly, is there a cost to MnDOT?
I think I can answer the cost of the question on the cost, and I think I'll have Josh Bergstetter, city planner, comment on the first part of your question. My understanding is that this would be a cost directly to the city that we would manage, we would maintain. I believe we would install them as well. So ongoing maintenance, we would maintain those as well. We don't believe that there would be much of a cost to directly to MnDOT. I think that would be something that I believe we're carrying on as a burden to the city of Two Harbors. And that would be paid by the folks that are actually listed on the sign itself through sort of a lease to the city. Okay. And then, go ahead.
Actually, there's a fiscal note that is not complete yet, if I'm hearing right here. But that should be done by tomorrow, or is that? That's the story of all our fiscal notes. They'll be done tomorrow.
Yes, and as far as the design is, that is something that we believe would be allowed under the existing sign program, except that it has five destination panels and it has the private business on it, but the general location, size, color does fall under the MnDOT standards, and what we based that design on was some sign panels that the state traffic sign office actually created for us.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, then just a little bit further on that. So I see a logo and Two Harbors. So in Beaver Bay, are they going to have the same look and the same, or a little bit, what? How different can the other cities along 61B or along 47 or other state highways?
My understanding is under the existing program, the individual city is allowed to have that top space. In the example that you've been provided, there's the Edna G tugboat, and it says Two Harbors across top. That would be allowed to the individual city to change something specific to their city, but the actual design of the rest and the size and dimensions and letter sizes, etc., would be required by what MnDOT standards are. Would follow MnDOT standards.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Representative, just to add to that, the other cities don't necessarily have the same problem that Two Harbors has, in that the Highway 61, to get to all the other things within the city of Two Harbors, you have to have direction signs, and there's no way to find the waterfront unless you have a direction sign on Highway 61. Or anything in Two Harbors almost. If it's not on Highway 61, no one knows that the rest of it is there because of the development of the city over the last 100 years. Whereas the cities that you mentioned are much newer.
Okay.
Can you see the lake from the highway?
No.
No. Mr. Chair, if I might also add, I actually own the Dairy Queen on 7th Avenue, right in Two Harbors, right along Highway 61, and it's a common comment from our visitors that they think Highway 61 is the downtown. That is Two Harbors, which is, it's a nice part of town, but in my opinion, it's not the best part of town. I mean, it's the area where most traffic goes through. And as soon as we tell them that actually there's a waterfront downtown, there's a lighthouse you can go visit, et cetera, they're very excited to actually know that. And, you know, I'd be more than happy to stand at the corner and tell directions to folks that are coming to the dairy or coming to the Dairy Queen, etc. But I think a nice sign program like this would be a better tool.
Do you have an information sign on your building?
On our Dairy Queen?
Information here?
I don't.
Oh. Other questions or comments? If not, we will move this to what? Oh, excuse me. Pardon me. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify? Got to be other people.
Thank you.
Okay, I don't know who you are, so you're done.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Sue Groth, and I am the state traffic engineer for the Minnesota DOT. Yeah. And I brought with me today someone to help answer some of the more technical questions, and I'll let her introduce you herself.
Hi, I'm Josie Taze. I'm the Metro Signing Engineer with MnDOT.
Speak up or speak into the mic, please.
I'm Josie Taze. I'm the MnDOT Metro Signing Engineer.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'd like to start out by talking a little bit about signing in general and to give everybody a kind of a higher level understanding about what we're trying to do with our traffic signs. And then I'll get into some more of the details of the proposed legislation and why there has been, it's been a while to try to get these signs up and some of the issues that we've been encountering with what's being proposed. These issues do have broad statewide impacts that I think the committee needs to fully understand. Talking about signing in general, there are three types of broad categories of signs, and you see them out there all the time. We've got our regulatory signs, our warning signs, and our guide signs. All signs, no matter what type of sign they are all considered traffic control devices. If they are on our highway, they are considered a traffic control device, and they all need to meet engineering standards. And these signs all play a very critical role in controlling traffic and safeguarding and guiding traffic to its destinations. All traffic control devices are governed by state and federal regulations that are outlined in the Federal and Minnesota Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices. So we have a lot of demand for signing out there. Obviously, we have to set priorities by what gets signed. We start, of course, with our first priority would be your regulatory signs, and that would include things like your stop signs and your speed limit signs or your one-way signs. Next priority would be your warning signs. That would be your curve ahead signs, your pedestrian crossing signs, your advisory speed limit signs. And then third is what we consider your primary guide signs. Those would be your destinations, your street destination or highways when you're driving down a highway and you see an exit to guide you to a particular street. All of these, after all of these priorities are met, we have signs that are called supplemental guide signs. And these signs are what's outlined in your handout that I handed out before you. These are all considered supplemental guide signs. And so what's being proposed here today is to add a signing program in state law that would add to the supplemental guide sign programs that we already have established. We do have, not in state law, but MnDOT does have its own policy regarding, what are we calling these? Community wayfinding signs, right? So we do have a policy already for community wayfinding signs. It's just not in state law. So this bill would put it in state law and then add eligibility that we currently do not allow. So I'll get into why we have some concerns about that. Okay, so after signing all these priorities, we sign for supplemental guide signs. The bill today proposes to establish a community destination program, and again, that's considered supplemental. So In urban areas like in downtown Two Harbors or in Montevideo, there is not a lot of space left for supplemental guide signs. So that's why we have to prioritize what facilities can have signing. And we prioritize those that have a broad motorist appeal, serve the non-familiar driver, or is a type of facility that a motorist would expect to see signing for. Because space is limited, we've established different business eligibility criteria that's governed by state law and in federal statute. So nationwide, the types of facilities that are allowed on community wayfinding signs are destinations that direct tourists and non-familiar drivers to key civic, historical, cultural, and recreational attractions. These signs should not be used for signing general businesses that do not typically benefit from the non-familiar driver, such as a tourist. Signing for general retail businesses that primarily serves local customers would cause the signing program to cross over with what I would call from being a motorist service. There's a fine line between a motorist service and advertising, and that's where our guidelines have really tried to distinguish between what's a motorist service and what's advertising. We know that advertising within state right-of-way is prohibited by state law, and it's also prohibited by federal law. So, federal regulations are governed, I already said that, by our Minnesota Manual Uniform Traffic Control Devices. So Minnesota already allows wayfinding guides, or if Minnesota were to allow displays of logos and commercial business establishments on these wayfinding signs, we would be violating federal regulations and the Minnesota Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices. I guess one way to think about it is, if you were a tourist or not familiar with the area, would you be driving through a town looking for a barbershop or looking for a hairstylist or a drugstore? Those types of things would not be eligible under current guidelines, whereas establishing or opening this up to all retail businesses would allow those types of businesses, and that's where we have to again prioritize for the business for the non-familiar driver. That's what we're trying to sign for in our right-of-way. MnDOT guidelines have never allowed any business to be eligible for signs. We've always tried to establish criteria, and as you see in the handout that I handed, the local the bottom corner there, it talks about the specific service sign program, and again, it makes sense what types of services are allowed on those: gas, food, lodging, places of worship, rural agricultural business, and then tourist-oriented businesses. Those are actually in state law. So by changing or adding this program, we would be, for the first time, opening up signs in urban areas to all retail businesses. The second issue that we have with the bill is that it is allowing or requiring us to allow five destinations. And if you look at the handout that was handed out that shows the signs, I think they have five destinations on there. And I, for example, these five, under current guidelines, we would only allow the federal manual only allows for three in addition to the Two Harbors symbol. Again, you got to think about, from a driver's perspective, how much can you read at one time? These are long names, and so we would limit it to, I think we compromised and said we would have four, but going to five, again, just adds to the complexity. These signs get very large. They're, you know, this sign itself would be well over 7 feet high and 6 feet wide to be able to fit these letters into that sign space. So that's kind of in general kind of some of the issues that we have about it. We have met with the city of Two Harbors on many occasions trying to work through these. I'm looking at this diagram here, and these businesses that are listed here, you know, they would all be eligible. They're not, you know, this would be things, again, for a tourist. There would be no problem, waterfront business district. You know, we have some criteria. What does that mean? And, you know, we try to put some guidance around what that means. Lighthouse, absolutely. Those types of things would be under our current program. We wouldn't need a law to be able to allow those. It's something like a lumber yard or a barber shop or things like that that don't have a motorist, a non-familiar motorist purpose to them, because again, that does kind of cross over into the advertising.
And I did note that in the bill, it does modify, which I think is important to point out, on page 2, line 218 and 219, I just saw this morning. I didn't really. It adds an exception, so it does add an exception for these community destination signs to all the advertising laws that would apply to billboards, signs, notice posters, displays. So they I think that the they are recognizing that this may be crossing over that advertising prohibition that's on state and federal highways. So happy to answer any questions that you might have.
So you're saying, Ms. Groth, that this diagram does meet your qualifications in some respects?
Chairman, yes. The business types, again, it's the type of business that we look at when applying the eligibility criteria. So the types of businesses in general, I don't know specifically, I would assume are. Would be eligible. We would take exception to having that many on one sign. Again, you're talking about a highway, the letter size, all those things. People have to be able to read them. That's probably having five panels like that with those long names is way too much information for somebody driving by. They would have 5 seconds to read, going 30 miles per hour, 5 seconds to read all that information.
Well, how about the shape of this thing? It's a little abnormal.
If the shape is fine. I did hand out, you should have two handouts. These are two programs, the City of Montevideo and, I can't remember which one this is, and Hibbing, both have community destination signing, and that's, so you can see on that drawing, that's what they look like, that's what the city developed and wanted, so we have no problem with the shape at the top, or having the city kind of uniquely identified on their sign. The cities that we have worked with like these signs. I mean, it kind of adds, again, a little bit of identification to the city as you're going through. So these are approved and fully meet the manual.
Well, structurally, though, this doesn't look as sound as your signs, which are anchored on both sides and have extra support, I guess.
Chairman, this is a pictorial. We'd have to see the actual design, and that would have to be designed to meet whatever standards are applicable for the structure. So it would meet those standards. So they could do something. I don't think we'd be opposed at all to this. Chairman, there is one issue that there's a requirement also that the height of the sign has to be at least 7 feet off the ground.
Mr. Chairman, it's supposed to be 7 feet for normal signs, but if a pedestrian's passing under it or possible bicycles, then we raise it to at least 9 feet so it doesn't clip people's heads.
The bottom of the sign we're talking about,
right.
It has to be 7 feet off the ground?
A minimum of 7 feet for ground level, but some it looks like there's a pedestrian walkway right there. We would then increase it to 9 feet. So if you go 9 feet above the ground, so, you know, somebody's riding a bike, they don't hit their head, and then you do the full sign height above that, it gets pretty high up when you're driving in a vehicle.
Maybe those would be reachable. Is Representative Bernardi around? What?
Oh.
What? Oh, Representative Swatsky. Some of these signs don't look like they're quite high enough to miss a bicycle person.
Mr. Chair, for these, they're well into the grassy area. There's no sidewalk next to them, so these would be 7 feet.
Okay.
So in the rural area, it'd be 7 feet, but in the urban area where you have sidewalk, then those would have to be taller.
Okay. Representative Swarovski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Couple of things. Did I hear you right when you mentioned that this was a unique situation coming into Two Harbors where it's the main go-through community? Are there a lot of, is that correct, that this is, and you just keep on going? And so what I was just curious about is, are there a lot of highway systems in tourist towns or in a touristy area like this? I mean, is this a unique situation to, have we heard about this throughout the state of Minnesota, so we're going to hear about it again and have to make special arrangements for other communities, or is this like a very unique situation in a very unique tourist area? And so that's my first question, if we know that answer.
You want to hand one to Ms. Goff?
Chairman, thank you, Representative. I don't know how unique it is. I would say that our issue is more with the types of businesses on the sign is the issue, not having the sign in the city, the signs in the city of Two Harbors. It's it's which businesses or which attractions are on the sign, not the signs themselves.
Okay. And then,
Representative Swarovski.
And then, sometimes we do a pictorial like this, and then it's not exactly accurate. But is this how the entrance right there, right in town, or is it something where it could be probably whatever, so many feet or yards or whatever prior to this, or is this an actual rendering of what the situation might be?
Pretty close.
Okay. Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, just a thought, which I'm not an architect or idea type person, but also would it be, if it says the Wilmer or the Visitor Information Center, I mean, is there any kind of, you know, on top of the building type of idea that we could, that could be erected so that there's, you know, using the existing building space? I don't know, but just wondering if that's it. Would be something, if it's that close to this intersection or whatever, if that's an idea that could be explored.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, there isn't the Visitor Information Center like this there. But there is a building. But I think that would, other ordinance or billboard kind of signs would not be acceptable in that situation. And I think the uniqueness is that maybe other cities gave up and complied, and Two Harbors feels that they are unique enough that they would like to be a pilot for six signs or six places or five places instead of just the four or three or four, and they would like to at least be given the opportunity to try their ideas and have hardware store on the sign and harbor, small craft harbor, and lighthouse and Edna G, all of which are way off of Highway 61. But the tourists would be thrilled to death to visit those things if they took a right turn. But they don't know where to take the right turn. Oftentimes, if they do stop at the Dairy Queen, somebody might say, oh, the lake's down there, and there's a wonderful place that you can walk way out and see the big ships go out as they carrying the ore to Gary, Indiana. But without a signage that DOT will accept, they don't get that opportunity. And so Two Harbors is willing to become the pilot for a few of their suggestions, if it would be allowed. And I have a feeling that if it's not allowed, Two Harbors will still be back. But it's time for Two Harbors to have some signs that haven't been turned down.
Ms. Groth, you aren't... apparently, you really haven't deviated very far in your suggestions for what a sign can look like from looking at these samples?
Mr. Chair, the sign design, as far as the shape and the Two Harbors, pictograph on top, is perfectly acceptable. That's exactly what the other cities have done with their own flavor. It is really the eligibility for who gets to be eligible to be on that sign. That again, it's the type of business. That we've never allowed any business on all signs. I mean, there's always been criteria, and again, it gets back to that non-familiar driver, the places that they would be most likely to want to go to, such as the waterfront or a museum or an amusement park, those types of things where you're going to be directing them.
You're not afraid, in other words, that you're going to unloose the imagination of every city in the state to design their own sign, as long as they put those couple of factors on there you want. And you can make them any color you want and as big as you want, or is that all in here?
Chairman, in the manual, it does specify, a certain color for what the set sign means. Informational signs are generally blue, sometimes they're green, and so those are all specified. But that doesn't seem to be the issue. It's really the types of businesses and the number that's allowed. Again, from an engineering standpoint, you don't want to put something on a road that people are not able to read and cannot react to in a safe manner.
Well, I would think you'd be somewhat interested in the aesthetics of the thing, too, but whatever. Representative Runbeck.
Well, Mr. Chair, having sat on a city council and sat through sign discussions, they're always super frustrating. But it seems like the differences here are sort of minor. I mean, it's 4 versus 5. I don't know if that's a big deal to either side. Who constructs the sign? Is that something that MnDOT is in charge of, or can the cities each, find their vendor to make the sign?
Mr. Chair and Representative, typically the city would have an approved plan from MnDOT, and they would hire their own people to actually do the installation.
And the concern is, Mr. Chair, that we're launching into allowing it to be used for advertising of specific stores and. Is that something that Ms. Two Harbors feels strongly about? Representative Murphy?
Mr. McDonald.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think some clarification, I guess, in response to your question is that if you were a business and you were located outside the city limits of Two Harbors, you would have the ability to put your private advertisement on one of these highway signs. And what is outside the city limits, I believe, needs to be specific to what a tourist or a traveler would want to see. I don't think you're going to see things like Lou's Fish, Kendall's Fish, restaurants that are off of 61, and then it'd have a directional sign. So having these signs located within the city limits would just be copying what is allowed outside the city limits by MnDOT's existing. I'm not sure if it's under statute or if it's under a signage handbook or not. There's some comments about the size of the sign. The actual size that is being described here is actually smaller than what is the allowed sign. My understanding is that it's 4 feet wide and 6 feet in tall, and what's allowed is, my understanding, is a 4x7. So even if we had 5 destinations on there, it would be smaller than what would be allowed under the existing community destination sign program. The main focus, again, is just allowing to have that private business that is located outside of the MnDOT corridor the opportunity to promote and make sure that travelers know that they are there.
So. Right, thank you very much.
Yep.
Yeah, I was just thinking we're going to open up a market here for some slick sign salesmen, if we, or maybe more than one.
Mr. Chair, can I make one more comment, please?
Sure.
Okay, just a note of clarification. I think that there's a misunderstanding about what's allowed outside in a rural area versus what's allowed in an urban area, so I'd like Josie to explain that because I don't think that that's clear to everybody.
Mr. Chair, there's a few things. He was saying what's in town has different regulations than what's out of town, and that's our specific service dining program. That's motor services, that's gas, food, lodging, places of worship, rural agricultural. Those are allowed in rural sections. That's why when he says out of town, we have a signing program for those types of services. Once you get in town, then we kind of jump up to the minor traffic generator that's on the wayfinding program. And those are more cultural, recreational, historical. There is talk about moving some of the gas, food, lodging onto that program, but we would still be open to that, but we're not open to the retail or commercial type with the lumber yard and the hair salons, but we are open to the restaurants and those types of services.
I think we've got another license plate started on a larger scale. Representative Beard.
Manicure.
Well, Madam Chair, Josie and Mr. Gross are starting to get at my questions because when you said no businesses were allowed on it, I'm thinking of the rural sections where actually name a business. Also thinking of the blue board and brown board program that's in the metro area where we put Valley Fair specifically on a signboard or Mystic Lake or something like that. Can you give us a brief explanation of the rationale behind putting some businesses on but not others?
Representative, Mr. Chair. So different types of roads have different signing programs. When you travel along interstates, you know, you have so much people traveling that interstate, you're kind of going long distance. So for those, we do more of the major traffic generators. So that's where you get the Mall of America, you get the stadiums, you get the zoos, you get, you know, colleges because they have, you know, the big football games that attract a lot of people. So we kind of say if you're on freeways, you attract the large major traffic generators for those types of signs. Mm. Then you kind of get more into like the urban area and stuff. That's where the minor traffic generator comes. This is the recreational, cultural. These type of facilities are more like your county parks, your historic sites, libraries, museums, stuff like that. When you go into the rural, these programs still apply, but out there we see more like restaurants, the gas, food, lodging, you know, greenhouses, wineries, things like that. So the different types, and when you get to more of the urban, like downtown Minneapolis, or some of the other towns, you're kind of like, well, you expect gas stations to be every so often, or restaurants to be every so often, so then we don't always have a signing program, because we directed you off the freeway with the logo program to those, and, you know, we direct you to the facility, but when you get down to the urban area, we do more of the cultural places because a park's not everywhere, but there are more food places and more gas stations once you get more urban.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it sounds like there is actually established guidelines and some rationale that's been given to this. Actually, I know the answer. The answer is yes, there has been, because we've been through this a lot of times in many, many years here. If we would order you to do this, we'd probably have to develop a whole new program that would be a statewide program. I don't see anywhere in here where this looks like a pilot program for two harbors. Is that what I'm guessing? This would be a statewide program? Is that the intent of the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's my understanding. This is a new program. That's why I was saying earlier that it has statewide implications to opening up signing in cities for every retail business, which is a very large...
Mr. Chairman, to the Mayor, if the City of Two Harbors Convention and Visitors Bureau, and I'm sure you have one, just made these really handsome signs and just put them just outside of the right-of-way along the main drag through town there. I've been to your town. It's a handsome town. Taking the train there, Representative Hornstein. It's a fun trip.
And walk, LX.
And walked up over the hill to your Dairy Queen and spent some of my money there as well. But if you would just do that, would MnDOT come along and take those signs down? Or maybe I should be asking Ms. Gross. What is the penalty for having Two Harbors just put up their signs because it's a good idea and they want to do it? Either one of you can take a crack at that, I suppose.
It's been done. We've had signs that have been removed
by
local MnDOT engineers and MnDOT officials. So I mean, we're trying to play by the rules. I mean, we want to try to play within the what's allowed. So I think I think that answers your question. It would not be allowed.
It does. Mr. Chair, I'm not trying to foment insurrection here. I'm just asking. But thank you for helping us understand that. Mr. Chairman, is this bill going to go to finance next? Is that where it's heading?
I certainly hope so.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would just require some Betty's pies if it comes to transportation finance.
Are we done with the question here, or we have more?
I'm done. Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just having a little bit of trouble wrapping my head around. So to the folks from MnDOT, just really help me understand why you're opposed to certain types of businesses being placed on this, what seems to be a very nice looking sign that fits well with the architecture of Two Harbors. And having been to Two Harbors a number of times, I can envision this sign and I can envision why the city thinks that this is necessary. And I get that, but I don't understand why you're opposed to certain types of businesses. And a follow-up to that that you can answer at the same time would be, as I look at the bill, it says that one of the things in the new language will be that the commissioner shall establish program requirements, including but not limited to application procedures, et cetera, et cetera. Now, why couldn't it be said that when we look at the types of information that would be placed on the sign, who better to make that decision than the local government? Why couldn't it be said that in your rules or in your program that you would establish that at the very least the sign content, if you will, would have to be accompanied by a resolution of the city council, let's say. So at least we have some understanding that the city government is on board and therefore the residents of the city are on board. So there's a couple of questions there if you could try to answer them.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you. I'm trying to remember what your first question was. You're correct in that the way the law is, the bill is written, is that the commissioner would establish criteria, but that criteria is specifically calls out general retail services. And again, this gets back into kind of federal regulations and state regulations regarding advertising within right of way of within MnDOT right of way or within right of way. So if we were to open this up to all businesses, we would be in clear violation of federal regulation to allow advertising. And there is, I mean, it hasn't been done, and I'm not just, you know, I don't know if it would happen, but there, you know, there could be some consequences to that later on when we go through to rebuild, like say, Highway 61, and are using federal funds. If they see that we're not complying with federal regulations, they would require us to get the program in compliance with federal regulations before they would fund the project. I would assume. I don't know. I'm not trying to throw that out there as a big scare, but I do want you to understand that we are governed by these. Regulations about advertising, which you can imagine that if we opened this program up to all retail businesses in any town, the sign, the clutter, you know, and here we're, you know, we talk about distracted driving and things like that. I mean, we really try to limit the amount of information that people are trying to take in as they're driving down the road. So that's my response to that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, and just a follow-up to that, and maybe to you or to anybody, but with what's proposed in the current bill, is the current bill, would that put us in violation of federal regulations?
Mr. Chair and Representative, my interpretation is that it would put us in violation of federal regulations regarding advertising in right-of-way. And the reason I say that is because I think even the author of the bill recognizes that this is somewhat infringing on advertising, and that's why they've added that exception on page 2.18 and 19 that exempts the community destination program from advertising device laws within state statute. That's my understanding. And
President Simonson, are you done?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't understand. Maybe council can help us here, but I'm really confused about whether or not the language in the bill puts us in violation of federal law.
What would you say, Counsel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, I would have to look into it further and confer with MnDOT on the specifics behind what pieces of federal regulation would be would kick in for the advertising side of it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I think hopefully before it gets to its next stop that we have a clear answer to that. But I do want to just thank Representative Murphy for bringing this forward. I think that this is a viable solution. Having been to Two Harbors a number of times, I understand what you're trying to solve here, and it's a good idea. And let's not lose sight of the fact that city councils and city government don't necessarily want to clutter up their towns any more than you probably do. So thank you.
Any final statements, Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I really appreciate your attention to this issue. And to address Representative Beard, when he said it wasn't specific to Two Harbors, we are willing to make it specific to Two Harbors and be a pilot project. But as far as the federal redoing Highway 61 and federal money, if we made it a pilot project, I think we could have enough experience ratings on safety and on the advertising, if it is advertising to say salon or hardware store. I don't quite agree that that's advertising. It's information to me, but so be it. But the district engineer was in yesterday. The district engineer of DOT was in to visit with me yesterday, and he asked about this bill, 2208, and I gave him a copy, and he says this seems doable. And so it would be under carrying out the pilot project would be under his purview, I would think, as district engineer. And if he found that maybe there were all the things that might happen that were happening because there were six names on the sign rather than four names on the sign, he could immediately consult with the mayor and the city council who are here today and say, you've got to do something now. And I bet the city council and the mayor would say, yes, you gave us our chance. We're concerned too. You want us to respond back to you, we'll do it, rather than just say no all the way through and have all those cars driving through on Highway 61 stop at the three lights and not have anything to look at and say, oh, we could go down to the harbor. We could go over to the Edna G. Oh, they won't have that experience if they don't have any signs. Please, help.
I have a question about fabrication and so forth. Wait a minute. Paid by the business. The program is managed by Minnesota Logos, Inc. under an agreement with MnDOT. Is that only for the one sign with the various logos on it here?
Chairman, yes, that is correct. Minnesota Logos manages what we call our logo program, which is the big blue signs on the interstate with the panels on it. That is managed by a private company.
Okay. So they, you pay them, or are they under fee to, how does that, how does the finance in
Chairman
that
and members, that is a contract that we have with them, and they charge a nominal fee, like $30 per panel per month, and then depending on the trailblazing signs, the businesses then pay for those signs directly to Minnesota Logos, and then the Trunk Highway Fund, I believe, gets some of that money back.
Okay. I'm going to move, since we got to get out of here, that we recommend House File 2208 be referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. All in favor of that, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. We are going to reconvene tonight 15 minutes after what? After 6 o'clock?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I know. Well, they'll have to, yeah, watch your emails. That's all I got to say. We're going to be talking.
Mr.
To
Chair?
And we're going to be in room 300. Excuse me?
No, Mr. Chair, I know that another committee has said after, because I think there's caucuses going on. So I think the idea is that the parties will caucus or at least one, and then after that's over, then we reconvene. That was the idea, I think.
So I'm saying the right thing or not?
Yeah, I don't know. I think six might be a little optimistic.
All right. Well, you have to watch your emails, but 15 minutes after you can find us. And it might be in room 300, and that's what we're counting on at the moment.
Okay. So we're meeting.
Oh, we're recessing. So we convene now, and we're going to take up Representative Carlson's bill because he's in another committee right now, and so we'd like to do that, if that's all right, Representative Carlson.
Very much appreciated, in fact, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
You're an ex officio, but you can't move your own bill in here, can you?
I can't vote on it, but I'm not sure if I could move it or not, so why don't you have somebody move it just to make sure.
All right, I will move House File 1302 for consideration.
Mr. Chairman, this bill deals with the transfer of a motor vehicle on the death of the owner. And the bill was suggested by the constituent.
Representative Carlson, we do have an amendment. Do you want to, as I understand it, I've been hearing an amendment.
You want to put that on now? That would be fine.
I'll move H-I-1. Anyway, we'll vote on this now. All in favor of putting that on the bill to have the in shape that the Arthur would like. Please signify saying aye.
Aye.
Pose same sign. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, all that did was clarify that word transfer on death of the title. So it was just some clarification within the bill. But as I was saying, that this is a bill that was drawn to my attention by a constituent who had this situation. And it would simply allow owners the option of naming a beneficiary on their certificate of registration to inherit the vehicle. The named beneficiary has no rights as long as the owner is alive. The owner can still sell or give the car away or name someone else as the beneficiary. In the case of a vehicle owned jointly after the death of one owner, the other would maintain rights to the vehicle until the death. A number of states do this. Some examples of the states are Arkansas, Arizona, California, Connecticut, Indiana, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, Nevada, Ohio, and Vermont. And to describe a little bit of the situation that we're correcting with this or providing an opportunity, for one reason or another, a woman's husband had the title of the car in his name. He passed away, and they did have to go through probate and a number of steps, and they basically jointly owned the car. When this was drawn to my attention, I remember my mother and father, this goes back about 25 years ago, they shopped for a car together. My father had retired. My mother was still working, and so when they decided on what car to buy, my father went over to signed the paperwork and all of that. My mother's name never appeared on the title, but yet they jointly owned it. I mean, they had dual income, and they had shopped together and so on. It was just the circumstances of the time of day, if you will. He went over, being that he had all day to go over and sign the papers and pick the car up. So they were in that situation. When he passed away, then it became a part of the probate. I didn't even know this option existed at the time. Otherwise, I might have been in with legislation 25 or 30 years ago, because he's been dead a long time. But at any rate, that's what we're trying to do, is simplify the process so it does transfer to whoever is designated on the title.
Are there any questions or concerns? Representative Neeson.
Chair and Representative Carlson, the same thing happened. One of my sons, the father of one of my son's friends died last year. And by the time they got the title, and my son bought the car, I mean, the car was covered with snow, so this would have made things a heck of a lot easier.
And that's the, Mr. Chairman, that's the whole point of the bill, to make it easier for people in those circumstances.
Representative Rundberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Carlson, do you know, for the title transfer fee that's usually charged by DVS, how that is handled under a transfer upon death?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rundbeck, we do have a fiscal note. I don't know if it's in your packet or not, but they say it's this has no cost to the Department of Public Safety. Well, we're talking, by the way, about the cost. We also inquired if there would be any sales tax impact, and Pulse Research said that we're not doing any changes in the statutory definition of inheritance, that there would be no sales tax impact as well. So if that were a follow-up question, it's zero impact on both counts.
Well, Mr. Chair, would it be possible to hear just a little explanation from Ms. McCormick on how it works, actually? You know, sort of the timing and all the different paperwork and you know, when the ownership is complete and so on.
Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. And it would be the regular costs that you would normally have when you transfer a title. So those would be the costs that you'd have. You'd have the title, the filing fee, and there'd be a transfer fee, and we have a public safety fee. My understanding is that the fees weren't the major concern. It was all the paperwork that had to be done in order to prove the ownership, if there wasn't any anything available, you know, in terms of a will or anything like that. What this would allow us to do is for this to be on the title application as to who the party would be that would be able to have the vehicle, and so then it would not be going through all the major paperwork that I think Representative Carlson was talking about, that is complicated and what I think have been the concerns. But we would have the ability, so that it could just be the transferring it. The only time there might be a concern would be if there was some kind of a lien where we had to get paperwork involving that. But in general, it would just show that we'd have a space we'd put on the title application that you would document who it would be the one that the title could be transferred to. So it would just be a matter of transferring the title, and there wouldn't be any additional paperwork. So,
Mr. Chair and Ms. McCormick, was there any time frame? I mean, I guess, you know, naturally you'd think the transfer would occur and this new document, so on, would be signed, you know, within, I suppose, 6 months of somebody's death, but is there anybody could do it anytime? I mean,
well,
Well,
I could put my husband's
title at it, you know, at any time. If unless there's a lien, you may have there. You may be additional work for that. But yes, you can transfer the ownership. But if you want to transfer it in this case, so that there isn't the tax involved, the motor vehicle sales tax, then that's one of the things that this would prevent, and you wouldn't have that additional tax that you'd have to be paying. So that would be the only thing that would be different, and you don't have to do that if you are a relative, and you can prove that. But with this, it would not require all the paperwork that you would have to go through, because you would be able to just transfer the title to the other person's name.
Thank you.
My understanding at Representative Carlson, just from hearing from Senator Rest, was that the issue was there was so much paperwork, and she had to go through all these different steps and go to court and all these other things. Sure. That was what the problem was. And this would streamline it, because it already be on the title application who the title would be transferred to, and so it would be very simple paperwork involved.
Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, Ms. McCormick, I have a question. If, you know, if we pass this, if and you have a married couple, for instance, and the yeah, they would put their name on that, but nobody died before they wanted to sell the car, is that a problem then, or could you still do a transfer even if they had that name on?
There are certain people that are exempt from the tax and everything. So okay. If you're a grandchild or a child or the spouse, those people are exempt from the motor vehicle sales tax. So that wouldn't cause, but this would have that all done so that there's no going into our office and then we're telling you that you have all these things you have to come back with and show us. We would already have that record, because it would already be on the title. So we would be able to start, you know, have the process occur right away and transfer the title into that person's name.
Any other questions or comments? Anybody from the audience that wants to testify? I see none. So I think we will, I recommend that House File 1302 be referred to the General Register. Excuse me? Now we're going to civil law. Okay, referred to the civil law committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All the same sign, going to civil law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Another
bill
up, so we'll see you later.
Okay. Now we're going to go back to the regular, which is House File 2219.
Good, how are you?
I'll move House File 2219 for consideration. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Representative Bob Barrett, representing Chisago County. You have before you a bill, House File 2219, that renames a portion or designates a portion of Highway 8 in Chisago County, the Nicholas Patrick Spehar Memorial Highway. I have with me today two people who would love to testify on the bill, and rather than me talk any further, we have George McMahon to the left of me, County Commissioner, and he is here in representing the Veterans Memorial Committee. And I have Andy Wilkerson, a community member as well. Andy came to me probably around 9 months ago with passion about this issue and really wanted me to work to have this happen. So I'd really love if Andy could about say a few words in regards to who Nick Spehar was and how we'd like to memorialize him.
Whoever goes first, and thank you for sticking around for the break there.
It's been very interesting. It seemed what you folks go through, I got a new respect for you.
Thank you.
a whole new thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andy Wilkerson, as Bob stated. I've been a resident of Chisago City, Minnesota, for the since 1985. Moved my family, or actually started a family in the Chisago Lakes area, and just love our community very much. Met a lot of fine people in it, and that's what made us stay. I'm a salesman by trade. I'm a regional sales manager by trade, so I guess you could say I'm a storyteller. And I'm going to tell you a little story about a very special young man. I first met Nick Spehar when he was 7 years old. I was the coach of my son's t-ball team, and Nick was and his younger brother were on the same team. He was a good kid. He caught on to everything. He was like a sponge. He just basically took everything in that we showed him. And you could tell that at a very young age, he was going to be a pretty impressive young man. Obviously, his family upbringing had a lot to do with this. The Spehar family is what I call in our community a cornerstone family. You see them; you would often see them around town. They do everything together. They were very passionate in church. They did a lot of... as far as just community work, they excelled in high school, both scholastically. They were all in choir, in sports, theater, you name it, they did it. The boys were all excellent outdoorsmen. As a father and a coach and a friend, I have to tell you, I've taken great pride in watching the kids of our community grow up. And, you know, I like to think I helped mold some of these kids. And I would occasionally see Nick, and as stated, I was very proud to see the young person that he had grown into. He was very kind and conscientious, and there was always a slap on the back or a hug, which you don't see a lot of young men do. My neighbor, Terry Willem, shared a story at his funeral. When he was roofing his home, Nick was riding by on his bicycle, and Terry was struggling, putting 20-plus squares of shingles on his roof. Nick jumps off his bike, loaded all these shingles on the roof and said, "Hey, Dad told me it's a neighborly thing to do." He had a lot of opportunities after high school. He graduated in 2005. At the age of 20 years old, he entered the United States military, the United States Navy. By 21, he was accepted into the BUDS program, which is the SEAL team program, SEAL training. And he excelled. Many people in this room have already heard what it takes to become a Navy SEAL, I'm sure. Nick Spehar made it on his first try. I'll tell you a little story about one of the worst weeks that you can have in your life as a SEAL team member is when you're in that training, they have what they call Hell Week. And just to let you know the type of kid this young man was, he called his family members and he asked them to form a little huddle around the kitchen table. And he said, "I want you to tell me the worst thing that's pulling at your heart right now. Mom, Dad, sisters, brothers, tell me what is anguishing you right now at this time. I'm going to take it to Hell Week and I'll leave it there. And it'll cleanse you." Just, I mean, 22 years old, this kid's asking his parents about this. Pretty special young man. He excelled at SEAL team training. He really enjoyed the camaraderie, the true meaning of team, and the brotherhood that the SEALs had to offer. He was a member of SEAL Team 5 when assigned to a SEAL team. We had all heard through the grapevine that he had become a Navy SEAL, and none of us were very surprised, I'll be honest with you, but we were all very proud. He had deployments in the Philippines and in Yemen in support of Operation Enduring Freedom, and upon completion of his second deployment, he volunteered for Afghanistan. In May of 2011, the U.S. caught up with Osama bin Laden, and he was dealt with by a SEAL team. And I have to tell you, a lot of us took great satisfaction knowing that we had a SEAL in our community, and that some of his fellow SEALs had probably dealt with the mastermind of the 9/11 attack. It was, like I said, it was satisfying. Coincidentally, later that month in May, many of us saw Nick at his sister Lisa's graduation from Chisago Lakes High School. That would be the last time we ever saw him.
Flash forward to August 6, 2011, and news started coming in that a Chinook helicopter carrying 30 U.S. service personnel, along with seven Afghan commandos and one Afghan interpreter, had been shot down in Afghanistan. Then on the 7th of August, it was confirmed that 25 SEAL team members, five Army National Guardsmen, were amongst the crew. Later in that day, we learned that two Minnesotans were on that helicopter, SEAL team member John Foss of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and SEAL team member Nicholas Patrick Spihar of Chisago Lakes. Nick was survived by his parents, Patrick and Annette, his sisters Marie and Lisa, and his brothers Luke and Jacob. Our country buried a hero on the 19th of August, 2011, right down the street from here. In the weeks that followed the funeral, many of Nick's classmates and friends asked what we could do to honor him. Name something in high school after him, plant a tree in our community park. There were a lot of different ideas. Eventually, life returned to normal, however, and talk of the memorial subsided. And I will tell you that was probably good, because time heals all wounds, and the Spihar family probably needed that time to heal. Nick is memorialized on the Chisago County Vets Memorial, thanks to this man down on the end of the table here. He's with other names that are from our community that gave their life in service to their country over the history of the United States. Nick also has a full scholarship named after him at Holy Cross University in Notre Dame, Indiana. It's dedicated to all children or veterans. In the spring of 2013, I was driving on Interstate 35 northbound, and I saw a DOT truck washing off a road sign. And the sign was dedicated to Officer Sean Silvera, the Lionel Lakes police officer that gave his life in the line of duty. That sign sparked this idea that we bring forth to you today. This young man's sacrifice has touched our hearts. And why not dedicate a road that runs through the heart of our community that gave him to this country? It gives us a chance to tell a story. It gives us a chance to be Nick's witness. And in closing, you've heard about the word team a couple of times in my short informational speech here, but when I brought the idea to the Spihar family, they all got together as a team again to discuss it. They even called in some of Nick's SEAL team members. And when I got the call back, they were all very happy, and they approved it, or I wouldn't come forth any further with it. I needed their approval. But more importantly, Nick's dad told me that Nick would like the idea. And I asked Pat why he would have liked it. And he said two reasons. Number one, it encompasses our communities. It lets everyone basically be a part. And number two, and very important to Nick, by honoring Nick, you not only honor him, but you would honor his team, his fallen comrades. Many thanks go out to Bob and George, and especially the Spiharts for allowing me to share this summarized story with you. I will just close with many thanks to you for letting me come out here today and give you this story.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm George McMahon from Chisago City, and I'm the vice chair of what we call our Veterans Memorial Committee in Lindstrom, and that committee is made up from Legion posts in Chisago City, Lindstrom, and the VFW. And since the death of Spihar, we've been trying to figure out something that we can do in his memory. And when we were approached with this idea, we wholeheartedly supported it and still do. And hope you can consider doing this. I can say no more. Andy said it all. Family. I know the family. As we all do, we live in a community that's close to the Twin Cities, but yet a small community, so we all know each other. So when this happened, it hurts all of us. And this highway, the memorial that we're talking about, be a great thing that for all of us to remember that family and what they've given to this community. He is our hero. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments from the members or the audience at this time? Representative Barrett, would you like to make any closing statements? Or?
Well, as George said, I think Andy said it all. He couldn't have said it any better, and so I would just ask for your approval.
Okay. I would renew the recommended House File 2219 be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All the same. Thank you so much for sticking around and telling your story. Very touching story. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Lillard.
Yes, I mean, this sentence is interesting. Is it in more ways? Basically, it's almost a non state source of funding.
Well, welcome to the committee, and I think that first of all, we ought to move the 2219 for consideration, and would you like to amend it with HRD 1? I would like to move the HRD 1 for inclusion in your bill. Any questions about that? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You have your bill in condition now for presentation. Would you proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier today, Mary, Representative Murphy mentioned that she had never been before your committee. I, as a freshman 10 years ago, I was honored to serve on your committee, and I'll never forget, as a freshman, I was invited into his office, and he wanted to know what was important to me as a representative, and I remember being shocked that I was even going to be asked what I thought as a freshman, and I thank you for that honor. I think you had a friend in the office. I don't remember the name of your dog, but that was the other thing that I remember.
That was Lisa. I still have those notes, so watch it.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair and members, one of them was Highway 36, and it's. I think we're all happy to say that it looks great and it's functioning very well. MnDOT did a fantastic job. Mr. Chair, this request before you today is it's really a heartfelt one, like the one that you just heard. This is. For Officer Rick Crittenden, who lost his life a couple years ago in North St. Paul, 2009. He was doing, like so many of our public service officers do, are out keeping us safe on a quiet, I think, Sunday morning while the rest of us are sleeping or, you know, maybe reading the paper or coffee or walking our dog. And he responded to a domestic and paid the ultimate price. I was on the council prior to being a legislator, and he was quite a character. He always he was one of those guys which I like in my life that choose to give me a hard time about different things. One of my last visits was with him at a Holiday gas station store, and he was ribbing me about something or one thing or not. And just another quick story before we get into the testifiers. We have a lady in our community that is in a scooter, and he pulled her over one day with the full lights and everything, and proceeded to write her a speeding ticket as she was going,
you know, perhaps 10 miles an hour or something down Main Street, North St. Paul, and gave Helen a ticket, and I don't know if it was torn up. I always, that was the kind of guy he was, but really took the job serious, and obviously, you know, keeping us safe and paid the ultimate price. But I have some folks with me that can tell more of his story. His wife, unfortunately, can't be here tonight. She lost her father and had services today, so that she drives around the state with the car that the city, I don't know if they're going to, they'll probably cover that, but that drives around the state and has a car that is a mobile memorial to all the officers, not only police officers, but highway patrol and other folks that have paid the ultimate price, and the city participated in that and other ways. But I have the city manager here with me, and he's going to, Jason is going to say some things, and then I have the police chief, Mr. Loth, here, and a dear friend, Mr. Workman on the St. Paul Police Force that started, kind of went through the career with him. Appreciate it if we could have them tell their story. Thank you for having us.
Who's first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jason Ziemer. I'm the city manager. I will preface the story by saying I'm the new city manager. I never had the opportunity of knowing Officer Crittenden. And in preparation, and when Leon asked us to be here today, it was trying to get a sense for who Rick was as an officer, as a human being. I spent some time with the chief and spent some time with the city staff. And I can tell you from a variety of things that he had an outstanding relationship with the community, with the business owners. He was the business beat, so to speak. That was his area of responsibility. He was really great with kids and was adored by the staff and by the city council, so he had a tremendous relationship. One of the questions was asked was how this designation was important to the community or the organization or the family. And North St. Paul's population, about 12,000 people. For most people, that's not a small community, but really it's a small, close-knit community. The police department, and especially Officer Crittenden, really is the epitome of a community police department. They know the people in the community, they're involved, they're engaged, they're out there on a regular basis getting to know people. And that was the one thing that he really enjoyed doing the most on his daily job. And he, like I said, he was highly respected and very popular throughout the community. So what does the designation mean? Really, it's one of those events that we all have in our communities, in our lives, that just kind of become emblazoned on our memories, and sometimes those things that are either hard to forget or those things maybe that you don't necessarily want to forget. And unfortunately, the unfortunate death of Officer Crittenden, an untimely death of the officer, was a tragedy that the community really has struggled to recover from, and it's one of those things that the police department still kind of struggles to recover from. And it's an event that the community still talks about to this day. And it really, it almost brought home just how safe and secure the community really was at that point in time, even with a great police department and an officer like Officer Crittenden out there. When something like this happens in your own backyard, you start wondering really, you know, how safe you are. So in many regards, you know, small gestures such as this, to put the sign up on the highway, Highway 36, for people that comes in, it tells a story, but it also kind of pays respect to a person that was dedicated to his community, was loyal to his department and his organization, and loyal to his family. So even though it might seem as a small gesture, it will certainly help with that continued healing. And it's a great way for residents in the state to honor a hero and the sacrifice that he made to help keep the rest of us safe. So I'll turn it over to the chief so he can talk a little bit more about who Rick was as a person. But on behalf of the city council, we are asking for support on the bill going forward.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the Transportation Policy Committee. Thank you for your time and consideration this evening. My name is Tom Loth. I am the Chief of Police of the North St. Paul Police Department. I've been with the department 25 years, 9 of which as Chief of Police. So during that time, I knew Rick very, very well. What I'd like to do tonight is I'd like to provide a brief history of the fateful day when we lost Officer Crittenden. It was on Monday, Labor Day, September 7th, 2009. I received a call about 8:45 in the morning from the officer, and was notified of Officer Crittenden's passing. And that morning at about 8:37, Officer Crittenden, along with Maplewood Officer Julie Olson, had responded to a domestic disturbance at a complex on McKnight Road and Skillman Avenue, which is just south of Highway 36. It was on a possible order for protection violation. Okay. The alleged male violator also had an active felony warrant and was wanted from previous violation of the same OFP. Okay. Upon arriving, the officer spoke with the female complainant and her teenage daughter. The complainant was concerned that her ex-husband was waiting in the building intent on harming her and her daughter. The suspect had twice violated the OFP during the previous 12 days. The complainant told the officers her apartment was locked and she did not believe that her ex-husband had access to the apartment. Once inside the commons area of the apartment, the officers searched a vacant apartment to make sure that the ex-husband wasn't laying in wait for them. The complainant opened her apartment and upon doing so entered, at which time a person came from the back with a flaming rag to attack the officers and people. Officer Crittenden shielded the mother and daughter from the attack and pushed them to the side while he and Officer Olson entered. The flaming rag was applied to the head of Officer Crittenden at this time. Officer Critton was able to fight through this, and as the suspect attacked the other officer, he was able to pull the suspect away and focus his attention on him. Unfortunately, during that time, the suspect was able to retrieve a weapon and fatally shot Officer Crittenden in the head. This allowed the other officer to recover and return fire with the suspect. The suspect was fatally wounded during this exchange, and the officer received a less than life-threatening injury, but was able to survive. The entire length of this incident was less than 1 minute. Also, saying about life changes in the incident certainly came to truth here. To a little more about Officer Crittenden, he dedicated almost 16 years to law enforcement, 9 years of which was with the North St. Paul Police Department. Additionally, he served his country 4 years in the U.S. Army, including a tour in Vietnam. Rick came to law enforcement later in life than most. Being a police officer was something Rick always wanted to do. When he finally had the opportunity, he pursued it wholeheartedly with all his efforts. Rick didn't know any other way. For Rick, being a police officer was truly a calling. In 1993, Rick began his law enforcement career as a part-time special deputy with the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department Water Patrol. Rick added several other part-time assignments with other law enforcement agencies, waiting to get on as a full-time officer someplace. In 1997, Rick did realize that dream of becoming a full-time officer when he got a full-time position with the Waukesha County Sheriff's Department. In 2000, Rick became a member of our department. Officer Rick Crittenden was a vital and integral member of our department. Rick was a big man with a large presence. He had a gift for conversation and humor. Rick had a commanding voice and an irrepressible laugh, two qualities you don't often find together. Rick was our business liaison officer. He was a field training officer with our younger officers, and he also was a coordinator for our reserve unit, a position which he shared with his wife, Christine, who couldn't be here this evening. Rick was a fatherly figure in our department to our young officers and to many of the youth in our community. They often fondly referred to him as Critter, short for Crittenden, and also as Grandpa Rick. Officer Crittenden celebrated his 57th birthday on August 31st, 2009, which was exactly 1 week before he gave his life. Officer Crittenden would have hit his 9-year anniversary with us 2 days after he had been killed. And it also seems appropriate that with his military service and everything, that his funeral that year then was on 9/11. So. But Rick Crittenden, his smile, the twinkle in his eye, his compassion, his sense of humor, and that feeling of safety he always provided has forever been taken from our department, our community, and his family. So I ask you, let us please proudly remember and recognize his life and sacrifice by designated Trunk Highway 36 in North St. Paul as Officer Richard Crittenden Sr. Memorial Highway. Thank you again for your time and consideration.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Wortman. I'm a sergeant with the St. Paul Police Department, and I've been asked to speak to you today because I guess I've known Rick longer than anybody around here, except maybe his son. Rick and I went to training together to become police officers, and in school, we developed a very close friendship because we had so much in common. We started out graduating from high school, both went into the military, both went to the Army, both went through airborne school. Rick decided he wanted to further his career in another field. I went to the Rangers, which was the time where I wanted to stay. Christine asked me to come and speak to you today because unfortunately her dad died and couldn't be here today. So she asked me to come and try to explain what kind of a man Rick was. I can't do justice to Rick from what she could tell you. Like the chief said, Rick was a very, very large guy and had a very large heart. The kids absolutely adored him. They'd follow him anywhere. It was like the Pied Piper watching Rick walk around. Rick went on to go to Hennepin County Sheriff's Department, work for their water patrol. I was a Ramsey County Sheriff's Department water patrol. Rick went to Wabasha County as full-time. I stayed here in St. Paul. We both fulfilled our dreams. As he worked down in Wabasha, my wife and I would travel down there quite often to visit. She's from Winona, so we'd pass through and visit with Rick every chance we got. Our friendship just grew. My wife, Paula, and Christine were very good friends, and we actually introduced Rick to Christine. So yeah, it's our fault. After Rick met Christine, he moved back here and came to work with North St. Paul. Was hired by North St. Paul police officer and served the citizens of that city with pride and professionalism. I have a picture of Rick on my desk. Every morning when I walk in, I look at that picture because that's the kind of cop I want to be. The kind that he was, what he portrayed himself as being, the professional. The question is, what kind of a person does it require to be have a highway in the state of Minnesota named after them, or part of it? I'd like to remind you of a saying often associated with first responders in the military, that no greater love hath man than to give up his life for a friend. On September 7, 2009, my friend Rick, while serving the citizens of North St. Paul, gave up his life for two total strangers. That's the kind of man Rick was, and he would have wanted it any other way. Thank you.
Any questions or comments or concerns about anything from the audience or the committee? Would you like to wind up your...
Mr. Chair.
Oh, excuse me. Thank
you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank the gentlemen for being here with their story. Just a really small little... I think a change to the amendment. Don't you want to have Crittenden, Senior? Wouldn't that be how it would read appropriately on the sign? Richard Crittenden, Senior Memorial? I mean, I think that's how senior is used when it's in a name. There would be a comma.
Mr. Chair, and I trust your input, and I think that's right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Do that without a lot of us. Do it.
I think that everybody's okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's just, thank you for all of you. I know it's been a long day, but there's few things we do as legislators that, really tear at our hearts. And he was really a friend, and appreciate you doing this for our community.
Well, thank you all for coming. It's not pleasant, but it is to relate to your stories about officer, but it's well worth your time, and we wish you well in your endeavor here. So I'm going to recommend that House File 2219 being referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
It's 1979.
Oh, 1979, excuse me. House File 1979. Welcome. Thank you. No, where is he?
Oh, yeah.
Representative Dill.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, we should ask him.
Welcome. And I will move House File 2425 for consideration.
Thank you. Nothing is simple, Mr. Chairman, members. Many decades ago, cold weather testing began in International Falls. My wife's family was the father and mother of cold weather testing up there back in the 40s. And that has progressed at the International Falls Airport for decades, and to the point where now they have huge buildings that they can take from 90 above to 40 below in a matter of hours, and remove trucks and all types of things. So companies come from all over the world to test their vehicles in International Falls, and they've really been blessed this year. They haven't had to use the cold box too much, but they use that cold box all summer as well, because the people come to International Falls cold weather test. They put the vehicles in there, run down to 40 below or 20 or whatever the number is, even though it's 85 outside. But they also take the vehicles down to, in the case of Jaguar, which is a very big customer of the International Falls area from Europe, Jaguar, the famous car, Austin Rover, others. They also go down to test tracks, which they either rent or own, down in Arizona for high altitude testing, up in Colorado, and places like that. They purchase, when they bring the cars from these foreign countries, they have to have a license plate, so they purchase Minnesota license plates to put on the cars. It came up that the law says, and if you read the law, it says, and when it was passed by Representative Anderson many years ago, it says, for conducting specialized cold weather environmental testing. So the purpose of this bill is to strike, I'm sorry, specialized cold weather testing. But this bill strikes specialized cold weather instead of environmental testing. And that way it's very clear in law that it's authorized to use that plate beyond the bounds of cold weather testing in Minnesota, which, you know, I mean, that could be year-round now with the cold boxes, but they could drive their cars to Arizona or to Colorado for the purpose of doing other types of testing. That is the purpose of the bill. The community has been, but it is not only International Falls. It is War Road, it is Baudette, it is other communities, because the falls got saturated enough with companies, and they're very proprietary about this. In fact, if you were in International Falls tonight, you'd see cars driving around with leather coats over the entire car and the wheels and everything, leather, complete leather cloaks over them, so that you cannot tell what kind of car they are. I guess how proprietary it is. So they've spread out across northern Minnesota, represent Fabian's district, represent Erickson's district, my district. And so it's a big deal, and it's worth millions to the communities, and that's the reason we're here before you with the bill.
Representative Dill, are these plates a special plate? They're not just an ordinary Minnesota plate.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. They're a manufacturer's plate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Are there any questions or comments here from the... How about you? You okay? Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick, Swiss Driver and Vehicle Services. This has no impact on our production of manufacturer's plates and fits right in with our process. We have no concerns about this legislation.
Okay. Anybody else? Questions? All right. Well, I would move that recommend that House File 2425 be referred to the General Register.
Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
All the same sign.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next time I'll try and bring a more complicated bill here for you.
No, that's all right. Well, do we have any other business?
Yeah, right.
No other business, yeah. So we will adjourn.
Right.
Thank you.